Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ziad Hanhan. I'm a thoracic surgeon with Hackensack Meridian Health. Happen to be the chairman of surgery at Bayshore Medical Center. Also the thoracic surgeon, chief of thoracic surgery at Riverview Medical Center. So those are my main two hospitals. I'm privileged to be joined today with two of my partners. We have Dr. Bauer and Dr. Niemeyer. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Bauer to tell you guys a little bit about himself and his practice.
Dr. Hanhan, thank you. My name is Tom Bauer. I am the chair of surgery at Jersey Shore University Medical Center and the southern region of Hackensack Meridian Health. We are all members of Hackensack Meridian Health School of Medicine and help lead our surgical residency here at Jersey Shore. Dr. Hanhan, thanks for hosting. It's great to join you. Thank you.
And Dr. Niemeyer, take it away. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Dr. Niemeyer. I'm one of the newer thoracic surgeons here, but not the youngest. Dr. Campbell is busy in the OR, so I'm helping him, but glad to be here and part of the southern region of HMH.
All right, awesome. So our topic today is going to be about lung cancer, and we're going to start off kind of with an overview, realizing that our audience is, you know, medical professionals that are interested in oncology, and a lot of the symposiums are centered around the medical aspect of it. So we're going to give you kind of the surgical perspective and kind of how we approach things. So we're going to start off with an overview. I'm going to direct this to Dr. Bauer. Tell us a little bit about the overview of lung cancer, number of cases in the United States, stable, trending, incidence, mortality.
So the facts that I think are key on lung cancer is, number one, it's the number one cancer killer of men and women. And most people, when they think of women's health and women's malignancies or cancers, aren't thinking lung cancer, but that has been the number one killer of women and of men. And it is one of the most preventable cancers, since 90% of all lung cancer is attributable to smoking. Next point would be, it's never too late to quit smoking. The moment you quit is the moment that you reduce your risk, not only for lung cancer, but between 7 and 15 other cancers. I'd say over 220,000 people pass every year from lung cancer. If we find it early, we're able to cure you. And so I'm sure we'll get more into lung cancer screening, but if you participate in lung cancer screening, your probability of being cured is over 90%. And so that is a huge factor for lung cancer, is that if you were a smoker, we'll get into lung cancer screening. If you smoke, please stop, because you're going to reduce your risk of countless other diseases besides cancer. And historically, lung cancer was felt to be a death sentence. And with the surgeries that Dr. Niemeyer is doing presently, and we all do every day, we're able to find it early, do it minimally invasively, and cure you. Those are the main points I like to make on lung cancer.
Thank you for that. So if you look at it globally, about 2.5 million cases worldwide. That's a number from 2022, and 1.8 million deaths. But of course, focusing on the United States is it's the leading killer for oncology-wise. So how do we detect it? So Dr. Niemeyer, tell us a little bit about, first of all, how do your patients present? How do we see patients in our offices? What's a common complaint?
The biggest problem, honestly, with lung cancer is that it's a silent killer. Oftentimes, it's found incidentally, and they came in for another reason. They fell and got a CAT scan, and they found a lesion on their lung. Some people will have a persistent cough that can sometimes be confused for bronchitis or just a smoking-related cough. You may have some hemoptysis or coughing up blood, shortness of breath. But again, these are pretty vague symptoms and can be easily chalked up to a lot of different things. So many times, we don't diagnose lung cancer until it's too late, and it's a very advanced stage.
We're seeing much more frequently see is the cardiac CAT scans, yes, that are getting done, and a variety of other images that have really taken off and benefit the patient. And one of the corollaries is when you're doing a cardiac CAT scan, between 60 and 80% of all lung cancers are in that field of view. And that is an increasing way that we're finding nodules present.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, unfortunately, that's great that we're doing that. But unfortunately, most of the cases that, if you look at it nationally, are at stage that are detected are stage 3 or 4, you know, the majority. So that's why the importance of screening. So who should get screened, Dr. Niemeyer?
The National Lung Cancer Screening Trial was done in 2011 and had 53,000 high-risk individuals. And this was back when they were either going to get a low-dose CT or a chest x-ray, which in the past was the way that they were screening patients for lung cancer. And chest x-rays, again, are not really great, especially for central lesions because the aorta's in the way or the heart's in the way, and you really can only see big lesions on a chest x-ray. So that trial actually concluded that there was a 20% relative risk reduction in lung cancer mortality with the low-dose CT screening. And this was really the first solid evidence in 2011 of lung cancer screening and the benefit of it.
So for our viewers and for family members, who should, what smoking, what do you use to recommend it to someone?
Yeah, so in 2021, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force updated its recommendations. So these are the eligible guidelines to be screened, and the people that should be screened are adults ages 50 to 80, at least 20 pack year smoking history, current smokers or those that quit within 15 years, and they must be asymptomatic. And these were changed from the prior to really expand access, especially for racial minorities and women who tend to develop lung cancer at an earlier stage with lighter smoking histories.
Yep. Thank you for that. So now that we have, let's say we have a problem, right? So now there's, you refer to patient and then there's a lung nodule, and then we'll open it up, see Dr. Bauer. And I would imagine we'd all manage the patients essentially similarly, but the nuance I think would be interesting to the medical oncologist maybe listening in. Let's say somebody has a 2-centimeter mass, right upper lobe. Well, how would we manage that? Would we go to a biopsy? Would we resect it? I know it's going to depend, but assuming a good surgical candidate.
So that's what we discuss with the patient is from that first moment, lay out what we think is going on. And there's nuances that there are lesions that aren't concerning or are concerning, whether it's spiculated, how solid it is, its location, other features. But if we take a nodule that to us looks like lung cancer, then we're going to be doing things in parallel rather than in series. And what that means is that it's our goal to get from the time of suspicion to the time of treatment quickly. Whether it's 2 weeks or 2 months, it really doesn't matter from a cancer standpoint, but emotionally, psychologically, it takes a toll on the family and the patient. So we will frequently get a PET scan. We will get breathing tests or pulmonary function studies. Most of our patients have some cardiac history, so we'll have them see their cardiologist or primary care physician, and then we will outline what we think the surgery is going to be. There are occasions where we will do a biopsy, and I'm sure we'll get into how we do that, but frequently, if it looks like it's going to be a cancer, then in my experience, about 95% of the time, if the PET scan and the CAT scan are suspicious for lung cancer, it what we're looking at needs to come out, and we will have set them up for surgery.
Yeah. So Dr. Niemeyer, that same patient with the 2-centimeter mass is a little bit hesitant going straight to surgery, and they say, okay, I want a biopsy. What is your preference? CT-guided, navigational bronchoscopy, EBUS? Well, how would you manage that or approach that?
Absolutely. I think it, again, obviously every patient is different. So some patients are at much higher risk for general anesthesia. And so navigational bronchs require you to be intubated, which for some patients that may be a little bit higher risk. So that's something we have a discussion about. But if you have multiple lesions, the benefit of a navigational bronch is you can target multiple lesions much easier. And you can access central lesions, which are sometimes hard to do with an interventional radiology biopsy that are too close to blood vessels or near the heart with motion artifact. So if it's a very, very peripheral lesion and it's fairly easy and the patient, you know, maybe is a little more high risk for general anesthesia, I would lean towards an IR biopsy. But with the new technology, with the new navigational bronch, with the Ion and the Galaxy, I think our targets, it's much easier for us to get lesions and to get multiple lesions with a biopsy.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I have the same similar approach. Sometimes we'll just go in and just go straight to surgery, smoker, a peripheral mass, maybe you could just wedge it out and then just be done. Some of the inherent risks with an IR biopsy, of course, involve a pneumothorax, and then the patient's admitted for 2 days with a drain sometimes. So you just go, we can just wedge it. But yeah, highly individual tailored approach. But Dr. Dodds, back to Dr. Bauer's point, we try to get, there's almost an artificial timeline in my head anyway, to get them a resolution, get treatment within probably about a month or so. Thoughts on liquid biopsy? Are we there yet?
So up to this point, I would say the short answer is no. I'd say our group is doing actual research on a study with our Hackensack Meridian Health Research Institute, and we've submitted R01 grants to fund this, but we're able to detect lung cancer DNA from your breath. And that may sound crazy to a lot of our audience, but we have demonstrated historically you could get sputum cytology and diagnose lung cancer, but we can diagnose lung cancer by getting the DNA from the breath. That is obviously investigational. And the blood, we can look for some of the genetic markers that we use of how to treat it. But in speaking with most of our colleagues, that is really secondary to having primary tissue from the tumor. And so as Dr. Niemoyer was mentioning, robotic ion bronchoscopy or interventional or some other bronchoscopic technique is our choice.
Okay. And I wanted to get your thoughts on frailty. You know, you can have a patient that, let's say a medical doctor will say, oh, they're too frail for surgery. And then we may look at them and say, well, you know, I can get that patient through an operation. What do you use to kind of figure out, is this patient a surgical candidate or is not a surgical candidate? And it'll help us with our medical colleagues understand a little bit of the surgical risk stratification regarding frailty. Dr. Niemoyer.
Yeah, I think the first test is always the eyeball test. So it's really looking at the patient and seeing, are they able to walk down the hallway without being short of breath? That's a really good one. Or a 6-minute walk test, and sometimes doing a stairwell test. Can they walk up one flight of stairs without being short of breath? That's really the first test I have. And I tell patients that it's really looking at them as a person. Are they completely frail? Are they on oxygen at baseline? Are they in a wheelchair that they can't? For what reason? Are they in a wheelchair because they have neuropathy, or is it because they get so winded that they can't even do anything? So that's my first study. And then obviously, as Dr. Bauer said, pulmonary function tests are really important to check the baseline lung function and make sure that they can tolerate, whether it's a lobectomy, a segment, or a wedge resection, to see if they have that function. And then obviously the cardiac status, because one lung ventilation is a strain on the heart for surgery. So a combination of all of that, and then having an honest discussion with the patient about those things.
And Dr. Hanon, if I could just add, you know, we as surgeons, it's the myth that if you go to see a surgeon, you're getting surgery because that's what we do. And I really want to dispel that, because we as surgeons, as a profession, and specifically our group, are committed to the best care for our patients. And so we are very much involved in a multidisciplinary conference that each of us leads with our radiologic and radiation therapy colleagues. And so we're providing access to other ways of biopsy and other forms of treatment, so that we're not just getting patients through the treatment. We're picking that treatment which is going to give them the best outcome and the best quality of life.
Yeah. And one test I use, in case it seems are equivocal, I will actually walk them up the back stairs and across from the office. You know, and if they can go up 12 steps and not get winded and so on, I've used it on a handful of occasions. I think I can get them through the operation. But I think the eyeball test is key. So now we have a patient, we have a diagnosis, it's a 2-centimeter mass, a non-small cell lung cancer. We get a PET scan, maybe there's some activity in the hilar nodes, maybe there isn't. When do we go straight to resection? When do we think about a neoadjuvant treatment? I'll leave that up to Dr. Bauer to kind of help us a little bit with your decision making.
So all of us in our group are very practiced in the art of endobronchial ultrasound. And so we have the ability to assess those nodes. And with current guidelines, which are constantly changing, the answer is going to vary year to year and maybe month to month. But at present, if we can prove, then we're more likely to provide an induction management, which means historically was chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and then we would still be able to go do a robotic resection. More times now, it is the chemotherapy with the adjunct of the immuno-oncologic agents, and then we'll go and resect.
Okay. Dr. Niemoyer, kind of any specific stage two, maybe we consider sending them to adjuvant, neoadjuvant rather, therapy. Where kind of you, when do you refer them? When do you say we're going to go to surgery? Is it stage-based? What do you use?
Yeah, I think, again, it's ever-changing right now, and there's a lot of really exciting data coming out, and we're very much in alliance and research and up and coming, and so we are now enrolling patients to have that exact question answered. So in the oncology world, I feel if patients see them first, a lot of times they're getting neoadjuvant. If they see a surgeon first, many times they're getting surgery first and then possibly adjuvant therapy. So unfortunately, there's no right answer, and there's no data to prove one way or the other, and so more research is needed at that point. But again, I think size is important. If it's a central lesion and you're concerned, the other day I had a large right lower lobe that was kind of close to the middle lobe and it would have been a questionable bilobe. So at that point, I think it's worthwhile trying neoadjuvant to shrink it so that you could just do a guaranteed lobectomy versus a bilobectomy. So again, it's always patient specific, but more data is necessary at this point, but it's an exciting field.
I think we'd all agree, you know, stage three, for the most part, they're going to get some kind of neoadjuvant therapy. Stage one, for the most part, they're going to get surgery. And if you got a stage two patient, then that's kind of where the nuance is. And I think we're all involved, again, and work very closely with our medical oncologists and radiation oncologists, heavily, you know, involved with tumor board, and we get a consensus statement. I do find that they tend to rely a lot on us. And if we say, yes, we want to, as surgeons, if we want to resect it, I think they're all for it. So I think the stage two patients may be bulky, hilar nodes, or maybe a bigger tumor, and then shrinking it, it's probably the way to go. But yeah, it's, as Dr. Bauer mentioned, it's ever evolving. And it's even to the point where I'm sure you guys have seen the studies where even there's a role for surgery now in stage four lung cancer, which I didn't even think that we would see in my lifetime. But they were saying for patients that even had chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and now there's oligometastatic disease. There was a recent paper. So that's kind of encouraging in some ways that we could even help the patients when the medical treatments are limited. Thoughts on that, Dr. Bell?
So for the last 23 years and more, we've been doing surgery for stage four. Historically, it was only a single met to the brain or the adrenal gland allowed for you to consider it oligometastatic, and everything had to be resectable. And there was a 20% five-year survival on those patients. You know, now the biggest change that's happened in our lifetime is when I came out of training, the five-year survival for lung cancer was 13%. It's now almost doubled. And the reason is because we're finding it earlier and then the advent of immuno-oncology. And so we all have patients that have gone through treatment for stage four and it's controlled. And we resect the lung and we cyber knife a bone met and we treat them with immuno-oncology. And 10 years later, they're without disease. And so I think I was on a call earlier today where we were starting to call cancer chronic disease because, you know, did we cure him? It would certainly appear it, but we're being much more aggressive and successful in cases like you described.
We talked about the solid tumors, Ben, that maybe they were palpable. Let's talk about approaches and kind of localization methods for maybe a GGO that's growing, maybe it's semi-solid now. So if Dr. Niemoyer can share with us how some kind of localization techniques that you utilize.
Sure. So obviously TGOs are ground glass opacity, then most of the time are slow growing cancers, but it's hard to know. And so oftentimes in the past, we would just follow them until they got really large and would wind up having to do lobectomies to guarantee that we could get that piece out because you can't feel it. There's no pleural, you know, involvement for us to see on an eyeball when we're in the OR. And when we're doing things robotically, we don't even get to feel anything like we used to. But even with GGOs, there's no solid component, so it's hard to localize. So yeah, luckily there in the past, we would use fiducial markers, which would have the patient have another procedure. They would go to the radiology suite. They'd have to get multiple CAT scans. They would put a small piece of metal in there. And then in the OR, we'd have to use a C-arm to localize exactly where that lesion was and try to wedge that, which makes it hard, especially with the advent of robot surgery, to have a C-arm come in and then robot come in and this and that. So it adds a lot of logistics.
To clutch a quit lock, right.
Yes.
Right.
And again, you have the risk of a pneumothorax for the patient. It's another procedure. They're going through a painful thing where they're having a needle induced. So luckily, there's a new technology that came out that's called Cytolux that we've been using here in the southern region. I think we've had at least 15 to 20 cases already, and they've been really successful. And it's FDA approved for ovarian and lung cancer applications. And it is a folate receptor, and it takes up into the cancer cells. So it's given to the patients in their IV in pre-op. And then there's a special camera light that actually will light up the GGO for us. And we can do a wedge resection or a limited resection for patients, especially because these are usually non-invasive cancers when they're in the GGO state.
So you've had a pretty good experience with Cytolux.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's very pretty pictures. It's bright blue and green and all these cool things.
Right. Yeah. And it's, in case somebody's wondering, also the patients have to stop all their B vitamins about a week before. And it's an effective way to do it without having to do an additional procedure on the patient. There's also ICG green. You know, I've had radiologists inject. Of course, it's another procedure, but they can do a CT-guided injection of ICG green, or which is a kind of a marking modality that is compatible with the robotic imaging. So you can also light up bright and green and localize the tumors. But of course, Cytolux would be our, I think all of us would agree, that would be our preferred approach, because it's one less intervention on the patient, if you will. But it does involve an IV infusion and for about an hour or so.
The other thing which we will be doing is with our ion robotic, for those cases where we want to do a biopsy, at the time of biopsy, we can place fiducials that are coated such that they'll fluoresce up to 3 weeks later. And so that'll be some more technologies coming our way. And next month, I'm sure there'll be a new methodology for us to be able to localize.
Question regarding approach. You know, most of us, I think, are default, and we're also, are very facile with the robot, and we like to use the robot, of course. But what instances, at what point you see somebody and go, I'm not going to do this robotically. Can you comment a little bit on when you're going to go straight to open a pneumonectomy? I think you've done those robotic, but in one cases, would you go open approach from the beginning?
So it's ever decreasing, because the imaging that we get, even around big tumors, you would say, we're going to go open. But Dr. Nimoya and I did one the other day that was 12 centimeters, and we could actually see much better by being able to see under the tumor with the scope. So if I'm doing a large chest wall resection, or what's called a Pancoast tumor, where you're resecting around the nerves and arteries up in the neck, if I'm going to have a big scission and a large piece of chest wall missing, then the cost of and putting all those holes in for the robot and then switching. So usually it's isolated now to either a chest wall resection or a complex mediastinal resection, where, and we all have the ability to go in and be able to staple part of the left atrium or the main pulmonary artery. So it's really isolated to super complex surgery that we're able to do non-robotically, but the vast majority, over 90%, I think, of all the surgeries that our group does is done minimally invasively.
I would agree with that. And tell me about what do you do as far as surveillance? Now you resected the tumor, patient goes home the next day, he's doing well. Let's say it's stage two, sees the oncologist decides just to basically do surveillance and not add anything else in the adjuvant fashion. What is your imaging protocol, Dr. Nimoy?
So usually the recommendations are for low risk features is 6 month CAT scan for 2 years. And then obviously follow the patient up and see them, look over scans, make sure there's no new lesions or recurrences in the area where you resected. Obviously, when they've had one lung cancer, they're at an increased risk of another lung cancer, ensuring that they're not smoking again, new stressors in their life, things like that. But usually it's every 6 months for the first 2 years and then yearly after that up to 5 years. Obviously, if it's high risk, they're still smoking. Some patients opt to still have those low-dose CTs or yearly follow-up for life. But that's really the main thing is at least 5 years of follow-up.
Okay. Dr. Bauer, similar approach. I would imagine Dr. Nimoy is doing what you're doing. But
yes, that's our follow-up. But the other thing that I'm sure all of us do is we're treating every patient in a very holistic manner. And so we're also ensuring that all the other standard things, which people sometimes forget about, but their colonoscopies, their prostate, their mammograms. And so that's part of what we do as a group to ensure that it's not just lung cancer we're treating a patient who happens to have lung cancer, and there's a variety of other tobacco-related malignancies that they can get. And so we're making sure that the entirety of the patient is addressed as we follow them. And as Dr. Nimoy mentioned, it's if it's not for life, it's at least into their 80s in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I tend to do the same. I tend to continue to do it. To me, to get a yearly CAT scan, even after the five-year mark, it's not a difficult test for the patient. And sometimes you find other things, coronary calcifications, aortic aneurysms, other mediastinal problems. So I think it's a good idea. I look at it and I tell them it's kind of an annual chest physical, if you will. And they continue on until they tell me they don't want to do anything. Or as you mentioned, if they get to be in their 80s, usually they're ready to slow down a little bit as far as that goes. So I think we are fortunate to have each other to rely on and just privileged to be a part of this group.
Definitely agree with that. And I think, again, we have such a great oncology group, radiation group, the whole HMH system is great and collaborative. And we text each other about difficult cases or concerned things and just being open to new technologies, research studies, and being up on your game. And I think our patients are lucky to have us and we're lucky to have each other.
In summary, lung cancer is curable. Stop smoking, get screened, and seek out a team. If you're looking for someone to partner with for the management of your lung cancer, time from suspicion to treatment, I think, is a one important measure. The other is the outcomes. And like our group does, we measure absolutely everything we can. We publicly report that data so it's available to our patients, referring doctors, and we compare ourselves to the country to ensure that every year we keep getting better. And our results are excellent, but the way that you keep getting better is constant iterations of what is available, like Dr. Nimoy is leading us on that trial, looking at the question of what's best for the management of stage two disease. You know, participation in clinical trials, whether we're identifying new ways to diagnose or to treat or to follow these patients, that is what enables us to provide best care for our community.